Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mehler here, and this is a really special Garden Talk day because we are celebrating Bayfield in Bloom, and we're broadcasting live from the Bayfield Lakeside Pavilion, and we have a lot of smart, good-looking listeners who are in the studio, in the pavilion with us for this special show. Love to see so many great folks who listen to public radio and who've taken the time to come on over and visit with us. And we have three guests who have also taken some time to come over and be with us as well. With us today, Janelle Ware, horticulture educator with UW Extension at Marathon and Wood Counties. Janelle, welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here, and it's also great to have Darren Kimbler with us as well. He's the ag educator for Extension in Iron County. Darren, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And also from the Wisconsin DNR, Paul Segan, a forest health specialist, works out of Hayward. Paul, welcome to you.
Larry, Janelle, and Darren, it's great to be with you.
Well, as we talk with these experts, I hope you'll join in. We're going to get lots of questions, I'm sure, from our live audience. But as you listen in, I hope you'll call as well, or maybe shoot us an email to our panel of experts. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org, and of course our those of us here in the audience who have a question, just raise your hand as a reminder, and Jill Nadeau, our producer, will come around with a microphone for you. Let's get to know our panelists a bit better. Darren, tell us about your work and some of your specialties.
Okay, thank you, Larry. Yes, I'm the agriculture educator for Iron County. I do a lot of different things in Iron County because we're a little bit different than the rest of the state when it comes to agriculture, a little bit further away from cities and markets. And so I work a lot with small producers work in the local food systems and such. And one of the main things that I really work on is maple syrup production in Iron County. Iron County is blessed with enormous tracts of sugar maple, and we grow maple better than we do corn up here. And so I work a lot with maple syrup producers and educating maple syrup producers on production and business models.
Yeah, that's I've had the opportunity to spend some time and work with some of the folks who get the maple syrup, and it's always a fun process for sure. Maybe we can talk about that sometime on the show. I think we have maybe in the past. But well, let's turn to Janelle. Tell us about yourself.
So I got to give a shout out to my volunteers. I coordinate the Master Gardeners in Marathon and Wood Counties. They are a phenomenal force out in their communities doing a lot of really good work. And then a couple other things that I do is I work with folks who have court-mandated community service hours. And so I've got a garden called Gaining Grounds Garden in Wausau. And so we're starting up yet another season there. And I've got another therapeutic horticulture garden with veterans. We call it Green Team, and it's right over by my office in Wausau. So those are a couple of the exciting things that I do.
That's really, really cool. Well, we can maybe talk about some more about that as time goes on. But Paul Segan, I want to get to you as well. Tell us about yourself and what you do.
Yes, Larry. As a DNR forest health specialist, I coordinate the forest health program in the northwest part of the state. I cover 9 counties where I provide technical information to private landowners and then foresters at various levels of government, county all the way to federal, regarding things like spongy moth or oak wilt, forest pests and diseases in general. So we're called specialists, but I often feel like a generalist given the breadth of knowledge I need to keep to maintain the job.
Well, I tell you what, it's always fun to have folks from the DNR and also from Extension, because you seem to know a whole lot about a whole lot of different things. So we'll give our audience a chance to join in. If you have a question, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org, and any of our smart, good-looking listeners here in the audience can raise your hand if you've got a question, and we'll go from there. Speaking of questions, Darren, what kinds of questions have you been getting in Iron County?
Oh, well, you know, we had a fairly slow spring, so I'm getting a lot of questions about why this hasn't sprung up, why isn't this flowering. We had several ice storms earlier in the winter, which is fairly uncommon up here. We get a lot of snow, but not a lot of ice, and there was a lot of damage and how to manage the damage on, you know, trees and shrubs that got ice damage. So we're still early in Iron County as far as the growing season, so it's a lot of those early questions that maybe people in the southern part of the county have already dealt with a month ago.
Yeah. What are your growing zones?
It's interesting because down by the lake, it's a zone 5, and then you go south, it goes into a zone 3 in some of the cold pockets. So I have a wide range of climatic zones I have to work with in Iron County. I need to be a geography person to know kind of where to how to advise people sometimes.
And that obviously creates challenges for gardeners.
Correct,
you guys deal with all the time. Janelle, you have been getting some questions about pests, as I understand it, and I was kind of surprised.
So
early to be getting questions about pests.
Yeah, we've gotten some questions about the scarlet lily beetle lately.
Oh.
So those have been active and getting people concerned. If you've got Asiatic or Oriental lilies, those can be very, very devastating. So I've gotten a handful of calls about that. I've gotten some calls about the eastern tent caterpillar, people suddenly seeing those a lot. So, lots of calls. You know, people just seeing some insects and wondering, hey, should I be concerned? Do I need to take a step here? And what I usually do is just let them know, okay, well, first let's send me a picture. Let's get a positive identification. And then from there we can either decide, is this even going to be something that's damaging? Do we need to take a step? And if so,
yeah.
What are the best methods to go?
Yeah. And, Paul, I'm sure that I've heard you've been starting to deal with the emerald ash borer.
Yeah, Larry, it's true. It's been an interesting spring up here in the Bayfield County area because in March we had our first county detection of emerald ash borer. In fact, right here in the city of Bayfield, I responded to a report and did confirm EAB up here. And then fast forward just a month later, and we had a first county detection in Ashland County. And so I was waiting for the day on the job when I'd get these two counties kind of bagged up here with the detection, and all of a sudden happened very quickly. And so with that, although that's exciting for me in a sense and a little bit of a thrill, it also has some important implications for those who own ash, both in a rural forest setting, and if you have yard ash. And so we could get into some of the details on preventative treatments and management if we want to.
I'm sure that's right on top of mind for especially people here. It's the first time they're dealing with it. What are you recommending just for the homeowner? You know, if you've got that one good ash tree out there or a couple.
Yeah, at this point in time, if folks are risk averse to losing their ash and they have a good quality ash, we would recommend treating anywhere in the state at this point because EAB is often much more widespread than what our detection efforts can demonstrate. And so it's safe to assume it's in all of the counties at this point. It's in a lot of the townships, even if they haven't been detected. And so there's a variety of over-the-counter products that can be used to protect the trees, usually in a form of a drench, a pour-on liquid onto the soil the tree takes up and provides systemic protection. But if trees are over 15 inches in diameter, it's better to have a certified arborist do an injection-type treatment, which provides a little bit better coverage of the product in the tree, as well as usually about 3 years of protection can be accomplished with that more commercial-level treatment.
Set you back a bit if you've got to do that treatment. Well, I'm forgetting the range of cost for that, but it's for 3 years. You get 3 years protection.
Boy, I don't know what the industry rate is right now, especially with changes in pricing, but I think it was around 10 to 15 a diameter inch a couple of years back. But The trick up north here is that although we've got the ash problem and borer spreading, we don't have a long list of certified arborists. So folks really need to go on to the Wisconsin Arborist Association website and seek out a certified arborist, or contact a local forester, or myself, my contacts online, and see what options might be available for a vendor to help you. Down in the south, it's less difficult.
Yeah, probably that would definitely be the case. Well, let me give that. I think Jill Nadeau has a listener here with a question. Hi,
good
what's your name?
Good morning. I'm Kathy from Rice Lake. And after a long winter, we had made a trip to the greenhouse, and we were captivated by a specimen of endless summer hydrangea and brought it home. And then I heard on your show that it was referred to as endless bummer hydrangea. So what should I be expecting from that plant?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk that way. and some that we can't talk about on the air, some statements about them. Well, Janelle, do you want to...
You know, what I would say is I would expect, as much as I don't want to say the endless bummer name, I would expect it not to. I would expect the first year to, it'll be fine. If it makes it the second year, it might look really, really beautiful. And then after that, if it doesn't, I wouldn't expect it to be a very long-lived shrub. They are gorgeous where they grow very nicely, but yeah. Up here I wouldn't, or at Rice Lake, I wouldn't expect a long life out of it.
Well, they don't do so well in the south, southern Wisconsin either, to be perfectly honest about it. Good question. If you have a question, again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or one of our smart, good-looking listeners in the audience. And we have one with a question. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Kate. I live north of Duluth. And I had a tree question. I went to my neighbor's yesterday, and the black spruce in our area are dying, quite a few of them. And I'm wondering if, Paul, was it that the tree specialist, if you could talk about that? I saw one that she had cut, and it was like hollowed out in the middle. It was just really dramatic, the number of spruce that are dying. And I don't know if you could talk about the insects or anything we can do about it.
Thank you. Kate, it's a great question. Last year, we saw a lot of defoliation from the spruce budworm in the Arrowhead region in north of Duluth. And we've also been experiencing that in northern Wisconsin, northeast Wisconsin, northwest, since about 2013. And this is a region-wide outbreak that has been lasting almost a decade now, and it will continue, oftentimes continues until a lot of the mature spruce, white spruce, black spruce are killed. I can't say for sure that that's what the cause is, but knowing how widespread that insect has been in its outbreak mode, I would suspect that's a factor for sure. And so what we're seeing is a lot of the spruce are dying at this point. We tend to see the crown of the tree, the spires, start to die, and then over time, next few years, the whole tree will die as it succumbs to other more passive agents, fungal agents, insect agents, things of that sort. So spruce budworm can be controlled with some insecticides at the homeowner level, and on regional levels, forestry programs have applied aerially insecticides. But in general, we're expecting quite a bit of mortality in the forest to continue, and it's usually more of a passive intervention where we harvest, do some pre-salvage harvesting of the spruce. But by all means, you can protect spruce in a yard-type setting if you wanted to with insecticides.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Well, we're broadcasting our Garden Talk show from the Bayfield Pavilion to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. It's a great event, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as time goes on. There's quite a garden tour. And we'll get to that, and of course we'll get to your questions. Again, join us 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau's our producer today. Clara Neipert, our on-air producer. Trina LaSousa is our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my three guests, Darren Kembler, ag educator for Extension in Iron County. Janelle Ware is a horticulture educator out of Marathon and Wood counties. That's the area that she covers. And Paul Segan is the DNR Forest Health specialist working out of Hayward, but covering a large area. questions for them, join in the number 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And we have a listener here in the audience.
Hi, I'm Paulette Smith from Hayward, Wisconsin. And I have a tree question. We planted a few years ago a couple mountain ash trees. Are they also subject to disease?
Mountain ash do have a number of diseases. Do you mean emerald ash borer?
Yeah.
They will not be attacked by emerald ash borer. They're not actually a true ash. They're in the
Rosaceae
family, yeah. So, but the four native ash that we have in Wisconsin, black, green, and blue, and white, are susceptible. And then the white fringe tree, which doesn't occur in Wisconsin. So at this point, you are safe in that regard.
Made the right purchase. Very good. Let's take a call from a listener on the phone. Phil, who's near Lake Geneva.
Hello, gentlemen. I've got a question for all your experts. I'll let them each put their 2 cents in. I'm an older gardener now, and I want to plant a tree here. And I've got trees in my garden from Delaware and upstate New York and a couple trees Michael Durivan handed me. What tree can I plant in my garden that long after I'm gone? Somebody's going to say, boy, I'm glad he planted that tree.
All right. That's a good question. And now, and Phil's in the Lake Geneva area, so he's way south southern Wisconsin.
He's down in that banana belt of Wisconsin, right? Yeah. You can grow anything down there. You know, what kind of soils, I guess, do you have there, Phil?
Oh, we lost him.
You know, down in the southeast, I like things like swamp white oak. That's a beautiful tree when it matures and you know, becomes a much older tree, nice open canopy. I think that's it's a native tree to Wisconsin, so you're not bringing stuff in that may not be suited to the climate.
I love swamp white oak, and it's not as susceptible to oak wilt as...
Right, the white oaks are not as susceptible as the red oak groups are, so it's one of those nice, it makes a nice shade tree, grows at a fairly decent rate for an oak, and fills in nicely.
Yeah, we've got a beautiful one. It must be more than 100 years old on the UW campus. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I used to sit under that tree quite a bit when I was in school there.
Well, Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think in general, one thing to think about, and this is more of a general comment, is that anything you plant now is going to have to tolerate and cope with the climate of the next 100 years. And based on the climate record in the last 100 or so years, we are seeing changes in weather patterns. It's tending to be a little bit wetter. Growing seasons are a bit longer, but more extremes, too. Yeah. More extremes of frost and in extreme weather. And so thinking about that in broad terms is something you may want to do in planting a tree species.
Yeah, Janelle, anything from you?
So trees aren't my area of expertise. I would defer to those two, but I will say that when it comes to trees and shade trees, I think my favorites are catalpas. So,
How long will a Darren? How long does a catalpa live?
I've seen growing up in Kentucky. I've seen some pretty old catalpas down there because that's in that area where they're native, and I've seen some around the Madison area that were fairly good size, and they do have a beautiful flower, trumpet-shaped flower, and beautiful big leaves, then the big
tree.
Pods, fruit pods. So they do make a great shade tree.
You know, if I lived in a hobbit zone of some kind, a hobbit world, I think that would be the tree that would populate the sunny landscape hills.
Well, those are good suggestions. So thanks, Phil, for that question. Let's take another. We have a person getting up here in the audience. Hi. What's your name?
My name is Dawn, and I'm from Hudson, and I'm a vegetable gardener. But for about the last 3 or 4 years, I have trouble with my beans. I buy bush beans, and about half of them will start climbing, and I buy different varieties and different companies. And so I have bush beans grow, and then I get tall ones and then short ones.
Oh, that is an interesting. And you're going with different varieties, too?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. You know what? That sounds like a real interesting situation that you've got there. I guess the first thing I would be thinking about is what's going on with your soil
Is there, like, what are you, using composting and things like that?
My organic material is really high in it.
I would imagine, yeah. Yeah, if you're an active gardener like that. Yeah, you know, it's, to that I would, my curiosity would go straight to the variety. So if you're changing different varieties, I'm not really sure what's going on there. Darren, do you have any ideas?
No, I've seen that occasionally in my own vegetable garden where I'll plant cucumbers or beans or something like that, and I'll get an odd one, and I'm like, well, that's just maybe poor quality control at the seed sorting at the company. But if you're changing varieties and companies, then I'm just wondering if you may have some variability in maybe nitrogen, because high nitrogen will produce a lot more vegetative growth. Now, I don't know if it would change the growth pattern from bush to a pole beam, but that's one of the things I would be thinking about is maybe you've got, if you're using compost, you may have some pockets of higher nitrogen because of just the variability in the organic matter you're putting in.
My soil test says low nitrogen.
Oh.
But I don't know. It's
well, it's a mystery. I was thinking about one of the vegetable gardens I had years back. It was, I was actually, the next door guy was a farmer, and I said, hey, you can put your garden over here right on some of my property if you want to. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, what was in here before? And he said, well, it was a chicken coop was over here. And I was just, at the time, I said, oh, I think that would be good. And I've never had growth. that first couple of years, it was just like unbelievable growth of plants. It was a lot of fun. So, but there was even some variability in that. It was about 60 feet by 10 or so, or 12, I guess. From one end to the other, there was some variation.
I see some of the luscious growth out of abandoned compost piles.
Yeah,
but they don't get turned. You just look, and the tomato vines are just stretching. You know, it's a full jungle when you see these abandoned compost piles.
Actually, is that a bit of a shady site where they're growing?
No.
Okay, I was thinking elongation because of shade, but maybe.
Yeah, that could have been too. Well, that's a good question. Thank you so much. I don't know that we got it all answered, but we took our shot at it anyway. Thank you. Let's go to Matt in Madison, who's on the phone. Matt, thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, Larry and guests. I have two quick questions, if I may. One is an insect question. The other one's a tree question. On my Mugo pine, I just noticed a cluster of about 20, 25 caterpillars. I think they might be 10th caterpillars I've heard of, something like that. They're green and black. They're only about an inch and a quarter long right now. I think they're recent hatchings. And then the second question, tree question, I've got a 10-foot, it's a young northern red oak, and it's healthy. However, it has an exposed area about 8 inches from the ground, like a canker or, something like that, where the bark is, the inner part of the tree is exposed. And I'm wondering if I should just take this tree down or try and bring it along.
I wouldn't take it down yet. I mean, well, go ahead, guess.
Well, so I think on the first question, what you have there, and the best way to confirm this is to take some pictures of it and send it in to PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Lab in Madison there. But it sounds like you may have a sawfly, pine sawfly, and they look like little caterpillars, but they're actually a fly larva. And they do tend to defoliate sort of the tips of a lot of our three-needle pines.
Yeah, and with regard to the oak, I think Larry's right. I would give this oak a fighting chance. Oak are known to thrive in a variety of tough conditions and recover. My guesses are it could be sun scald, which can cause a little bit of sections of the tissue to die, and then they form a canker, a localized area of dead tissue around there. And they can cover that with wound wood over time. Some callus tissue can form over that. The other idea is maybe it was girdled by a rabbit. And also that can be a problem that will resolve in time, too. Good advice there would be to, if you really want to know more, take a photo and send it to Mike Hillstrom is my counterpart down in around the Madison area. He's very good and could take a quick look at a photo and give you a recommendation.
It's one of the few times if you get a real bad break on an oak, it's one of the few times where you'd use a paint or something. Otherwise, you wouldn't use, we don't recommend them, I don't think, anymore.
Right, yeah, to avoid oak wilt, you don't usually recommend paint, but if you, because of oak wilt and picnic beetles, which are attracted to the sweet sap and smell of fresh wounds on oak, that you might want to, first of all, trim the branch flush. You don't want to have a ragged edge because it's a lot harder to cover in paint, and then paint that wound to prevent that.
Yeah, and we should note we are in the oak wilt high risk period right now, which goes from about April through July. So any injury to oaks that are either human caused or through Mother Nature, try to get those cleaned and painted right away within about 48 hours or less.
Yeah.
Really important.
Some of the research, I know they tried some research to see how quickly the picnic beetles would get there. And I think it was within a minute or two. Literally, that when they were just taking a test of it, that they had picnic beetles within minutes.
Yeah, their olfactory scent, their smell ability is incredible. I remember harvesting an oak wilt sample a few years ago out with the forester in Washburn County, and I came back to the part where I harvested a sample with my hatchet about 2 minutes later, and there were already nitidulid picnic beetles showing up at that wound site. It was about second week of June. So it was proof of concept that is true. They are quick.
Yeah, they are indeed. Well, let's take another call. Jenny in Brookfield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I'm calling because we live on somewhat of a busy road with a pretty large size front yard, and we currently have two massive spruce trees that are dying of some kind of a pine needle disease. So we'd like to replace them with something that, you know, gives us that cover from the road, but that's, you know, big and gorgeous and beautiful. Do you have any suggestions?
So you want to, is this a screening kind of situation that you are looking for, Jenny?
Yeah, suggestions on trees that could give us some, you know, shade from the road, maybe dampen some of the sound, because our spruce trees were doing a good job until they started suffering from this disease. So we want to replace them.
All right.
So it sounds like were these blue spruce? Blue spruce is one of those trees that's widely planted around the state, and they suffer from needle cast disease very easily because our humidity here is much higher than it is out in Colorado, and they just suffer. When the blue spruces get so big, and I forget, where are you located at?
Brookfield, so
Milwaukee. So down the south. It's hard to find good screening trees. I usually like to plant in taller trees with maybe a shrub line underneath, a more, you know, shade tolerant shrub line to kind of make a living fence, as opposed to trying to use one large tree with foliage from top to bottom, because you're gonna have a little more variability, and I think it serves the same purpose without putting all your eggs into one tree, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't hurt to have a little variety, too. You don't have to have all the same trees. Darren, you were going to comment?
Well, I'm really intrigued by the idea of Don Redwood. I haven't grown it myself, but I know it's been more widely utilized. It's kind of a species that was thought to be extinct, Don Redwood, but then it was discovered, I think, back in the 50s, and it has been made retail available, and it's a very nice evergreen that tends to grow quite well in that zone around Brookfield. I think Don Redwood might be one to look at. I don't know if any of the Canadian yew would be a potential. I know up here we have major problems with deer with Canada yew, but that might be one to look at as well for a shrub and a screener.
Yeah. Did that help you out, Jenny?
Definitely, very much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And let's take a question from the audience.
My name is John Sapinek. I live over in Washburn. And my wife and I, our property, we have a kind of a unique soil structure of sandy loam on top of a clay pan, and there's a perched water table. And I'm very interested, and my wife as well, in white oaks and planting different types of white oaks. And, you know, we kind of understand the basics, protect it from deer, things like that. But if there were any other tips as far as white oaks, currently we've planted bur oak and swamp white. And we've had mixed success, and so I was curious if there's any tips you might have kind of above and beyond the typical, you know, protecting from wildlife and things like that. So.
Yeah. Okay. Darren, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, that's a fun soil structure. I have a similar one over where I live where I have that hard pan about 2.5 feet down, and it's great if you have a dry summer because the moisture stays in there, but spring just seems like it just stays wet and wet and wet. And I think, you know, bur oak is probably more adaptable up here than swamp white oak. But I think, you know, as we were saying earlier about climate change, you know, swamp white oak and even, you know, the regular white oak will start to become more popular. One that may also work, since you're in Bayfield County and you're, what, Zone 5 up here, is chinkapin oak. I like chinkapin. It's only native, I think, to the very southwestern corner of Wisconsin, but that's a really great oak that works well in fairly heavy soils and might do well, too.
Yeah, all right. That's a good question. Thank you so much. Let's take another question from a listener or from a person in the audience.
Hello, glad to be here. I'm Joe Passano. We live in Stevens Point, but we like to sail up here, so we're waiting for summer to start. But back to the earlier question about oak wilt and picnic beetles.
Yeah.
A few years ago in the winter, I had, I think, 4 oaks taken down in Stevens Point area, I think because of the oak wilt kind of going through the roots and so on. And right after that, I, in the spring, realized there were 1,000 picnic beetles on the stumps. I'm bringing this question because you already addressed this, but is the picnic beetle a vector or carrier of the oak wilt? You didn't make that clear, so can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, Joe. So yes, the picnic beetle is what we call a vector for the oak wilt disease in that it carries the disease spores from an oak that died the prior year and produces fungal mats that form under the bark. They have a fruity odor, attract the beetles. The beetles then inadvertently carry away these spores and visit a recently injured oak. If an oak's been injured within the last 72 hours, it's oozing out some sap. That sap attracts the beetle that's, in fact, carrying the spores, and they visit that site to feed and inadvertently deposit the spore. And thus, the cycle continues. That tree gets diseased. Once it's in that tree, it can spread below ground through connected root systems. Oftentimes, oaks graft to one another, red oak to red oak, white oak to white oak, and we get below ground, what we call below ground spread. So what you saw was, in fact, probably nidodulids being attracted to the stump, which might have had some spore mats on it, or potentially if there was some oozing sap from those cut trees that were still had a living root system, flushing out some sap, maybe they were attracted to that and feeding on it.
Yeah,
Yeah, just like Darren was saying, you can paint stumps if these stumps are produced in April through July and cover them with a surface protectant, a latex-based paint or a proper pruning sealer. The outer 3 inches are where the sapwood is, and that's the area you want to protect, or any other injuries on the tree. So that's a good surface protectant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. And another person in the audience with a question. Hi.
Hello. My name is Linda. I live around Eau Claire. And the last couple of years, I've had 2 weeds kind of appear in my yard. And from Google searches, one is Asiatic daylily, and the other is like sticky weed or Velcro weed or sticky willy or whatever. But are you familiar with those? And is there anything besides just pulling them up to help control them?
You know what I would want to do is take a look at those pictures. I know daylilies and I know Asiatic lilies, so I would want to get a better, you know, make sure that we've got a good ID on them first.
I don't even know why it's called a lily. It's a vine with a very tiny purple flower, but that's what it comes up as.
Got it. Okay, so I think the steps that I would take is first, make sure that we've got a positive identification. Once we've got that, I would literally, this is how I do things, is I'll Google a fact sheet, a UW fact sheet. If I can't find one from UW, I will find one from either Minnesota or Michigan, someplace close by, that they're going to have similar conditions that we have. And then I'll take a look at what those control measures are. It's going to be a little bit different depending on the life cycle. If it's an annual weed versus a perennial weed, you're probably going to take a little bit different approach. And then the fact sheet will give you, based off of the life cycle, it's going to give you some really good control measures. Probably start with, you know, good old mechanical, getting out there and pulling the weeds. But if that's not enough, it will help you out with chemical control methods, and especially depending, again, on the life cycle. Is it an annual or a perennial? A lot of times with the chemical controls, timing is really the key to the effectiveness of it. So that will that's where I would go. Start with making sure that we've got a positive ID. I'm sure you probably, you said Eau Claire, so I'm sure you could probably reach out to your extension people out there and kind of start that process. They'll walk you through the...
You have no personal info or knowledge of those two items, though.
So the question on the one where you said it was a vine with a small purple flower, does those leaves kind of have a scalloped edge?
No.
I'm going to say, because you started to sound like Creeping Charlie.
That's
there.
What I was thinking, too.
So...
Well, that vine, I mean, for sure you can pull that vine. You're not going to have...
It's everywhere.
It's not like quack grass.
Yeah. It would be something you'd want to send in some pictures to get a positive ID, like Janelle said.
We'll talk later.
All right, and she's probably got the pictures right on her,
see those
right on her telephone. So so there you go. But Creeping Charlie, daughter Emily, who's here, and I would sometimes in the spring, in the lawn, we just go... spend a half hour, you'd be amazed at how much you can eliminate, and then the lawn has a chance to kind of outcompete the other.
I think of Creeping Charlie as we lost the war, but we still have the rear guard action battles for it.
there you go. Yeah. Let's take a call from Louie and O'Connell.
Yes. Question about stabilizing a riverbank to keep the soil from eroding. We do have some boat traffic that, you know, the waves kind of probably do some damage, but anything, either grasses or shrubs, that would work for that, and also just avoiding the grasses that have like an awn on it because of animals.
I would suggest you probably reach out to your land and water conservation in Oconto County there to talk with them, because they're going to be probably the ones best suited to answer a bank stabilization question.
Especially for your lake and for your area. So that might be a good... There are some natives that work pretty well and get down there. I mean, the roots get down pretty deeply and can be quite effective. I'm not mistaken, Janelle.
Yeah, again, I would reach out to them to get the list of plants that are going to be really well-suited in Oconto, just to make sure that we, first of all, following regulations, of course, but they will know what will work well in that area.
Appreciate the call. Thank you so much. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network with our guests, Darren Kimbler, Janelle Ware, and Paul Segan. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio and Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off Bayfield in Bloom Week. And there's lots of fun things that we can talk about. There's a garden tour that looks fabulous. I think there are 18 stops, all pretty close together, so it's easy to get around. And let's see, if you type in Bayfield in Bloom, you're going to get a look at the tour map. And it's Saturday, June 11th, so it's coming up another week. From 10 to 3 is this garden tour, which I would certainly love to go through this. I know there are some beautiful gardens in this area, for sure. Darren Kimbler, Janelle Ware, and Paul Segan, our guests today, and lots of callers online, and we got some questions from the audience as well, so let's go there.
Hi, my name is Max, and we're from Florida, Jim and I, and my question to all of you is, what edible plants can I grow in a sailboat for the summer in this area?
I know the answer to, well, no, go ahead.
In a sailboat, so I'm thinking containers, and I'm starting to wonder, you know, and you want edible plants, right?
Absolutely.
So
yes.
I know of this great little cultivar of tomato. It makes these beautiful cherry tomatoes, but they're rather plump. So when you think of a cherry tomato, this is going to be like a cherry plus tomato. Cute as can be, the name of it is Red Robin. A very, very stout stem on it, and it'll grow in a 6-inch container. So that might be fun to have some cherry tomatoes out there on the boat. The other things I immediately start thinking about are just, of course, your herbs. And, you know, you can always have a little bit of basil. And I'm just going to share with you because you asked. And so I would absolutely bring a little lemon verbena with me. It's got a fantastic smell. It's got a very lemon smell, like a lemon balm, but a little bit more in the lemon candy smell. It smells really like a lemon drop. So I think that might be fun to, you know, have something different and fresh nearby to smell. And lemon verbena is fantastic to add to, you know, your waters or teas. Or one of my favorite things to do with it is adding it with I'll take a bunch of leaves and mash them in with sugar, and then I'll have a little lemon sugar for whatever I would want lemon sugar for.
Ooh, I like that. You want to come down and start one of those pots in my... I don't have a sailboat, but I'm on dry land, but that'd be okay. That'd be wonderful. Well, Kathy on the phone from East Appear has something for us. Kathy, hi.
Hi. See, I have three evergreens in my backyard that are losing their branches from the bottom up. One is my neighbor's, and then there's two in my yard. And then west of that, I have a great big cottonwood tree. And I'm wondering, is the cottonwood sucking up the water? Is that why we're losing these trees? Or my neighbor seems to think it's the shade from the cottonwood.
No, wrong again. Darren's looking like he wants to answer here.
So again, are these blue spruce, or do you know what kind of conifers are they? Are
they're not blue spruce? No, they do have cones. Maybe a fir.
Are the cones hanging down and kind of brown and woody, or are they sticking up and looking a little fleshy?
No, they're down.
Yeah, so most likely it is probably, and they're about, the cones are maybe, an inch and a half, 2 inches in length.
I think they're more like 3 inches.
Okay, yeah. So my guess is you do have spruce, it sounds like, possibly, and there's a lot of needle cast diseases that affect spruces. Blue spruces in particular we talk about all the time with the Rhizophora needle cast, but there are other needle cast diseases, and it's just a product of trees that are probably in a little too humid environment for where they're growing. The cottonwood probably is not contributing a lot to their demise. It's just a problem. Are they planted too closely together? How closely together are they planted?
My two their branches touch. But yeah. The neighbor's is a little further away.
Right. So
and
that extra,
the one,
by being all dense, that the humidity is there. There's not airflow. Water doesn't dry.
Right.
And you wind up getting these needle cast diseases.
So not much to be done about that?
Well, there are some things that can be done. What I tend to recommend with rhizosphere and needle cast diseases in general is improving air circulation, and that can be accomplished by doing some pruning and increasing some of that airflow. The other thing is sanitation on the site. This disease spreads by rain splash when needles fall on the ground or they hang on the tree, and they splash during rains to other needles, and they move from the top, from the bottom up. And so by getting those needles cleaned up off the site, composted many feet away from those trees, is a good process to get these trees doing better. The other thing is surface protectants. You can use copper-based fungicides to protect the trees, but this is rather involved. And so you're going to be doing two applications per spring, and you're going to want to change up the fungicide each year to prevent tolerance to it. So there's a process you can go through, and there's a great UW Extension pub to look at for that. If you wanted to go that route, might be easier just to think about a replacement too. So a couple of options there.
You may want to sacrifice that middle tree between the two.
Yeah, a little pruning right at the base.
Right.
One cut.
Just one prune. All it takes.
Well, here's a question from someone in the audience. Hi.
Hello. My name is Linda. I live in Bayfield, and I've got a problem area in my yard. It's pretty close to some very, very large pine trees, but it's all cleared, and I cannot get grass to grow there. What is your advice for a large bare spot that dandelions will not even grow there?
You know, so my husband's in the audience, and I can already tell he's giving me a look because I came up with a solution to a very similar problem. So I had a bare spot in my backyard. I live in Stevens Point in town, close to campus, and so I've got very old compacted soils, urban compacted soils. Nothing was growing there, and then on top of it, it would not nothing would withstand the traffic of my dog being in that area too. So I kind of, you can picture what I've got going on here. And also very shady, so that may be part of the issue that you're dealing with. What I finally helped convince the household to do is, you know, not fight against Mother Nature anymore, but instead work with her. And so it's a shady area, so what I did was I built up that soil with a lot of compost, a lot of organic matter. I added a little bit of bagged topsoil and some compost, built up that space, added some perennials that I know will grow in that space with the shade and everything, and then mulched the rest of it. Because for me, the issue is, you know, having that bare soil just brings the dirt into the house, and it's just a lot of work on my end. So I didn't necessarily, for me and my needs, I didn't necessarily need grass growing there. It's not necessarily a place where I've got young children playing or anything like that. It was more of, you know, my needs were to get rid of that bare spot. And so I mulched it, added some perennials this year, and then I also kind of tucked in a bunch of annuals just to give me some color, because I know it's going to be a few years before those perennials really fill in that space.
All right, very good and complete answer to someone who has, it sounds like you've been working on this for a little while, Janelle.
You know, it's a little bit of work, both in conversations and convincing other members of my household, as well as the physical work.
Oh, my goodness. Let me see here, just a quick look around. I've got another person in the audience with a question.
Yes, I'm Dolly, and I live in Marathon County, Stratford. We have a 60-acre parcel, and it is full of buckthorn.
Oh.
What can I do? Is there an easy way to get rid of it?
No easy way. It's all work.
Well, buckthorn is one of those problems that statewide, region-wide, maybe nationwide, at least in the Northeast, and there's a variety of ways to treat it with both mechanical means, pulling it out, but then also chemical means to spray it. Buckthorn is one of those interesting invasives that has a sunlight advantage over many other trees, and so you can easily identify it if you wait until the fall, because it's often one of the shrubs that keeps its leaves the longest. And so what I'd recommend is almost going out in the fall and identifying it based on the presence of leaves while all of the other shrubs don't have them. Mark it out and then research ahead of time what product would be best to treat if you want to go a chemical route on it. Buckthorn, if cut and left to grow back, will grow back very aggressively. You will only tick it off. So you want to get your ducks in a row prior with the right herbicide if you're going to go that route, and then figuring out about disposal. Buckthorn is dioecious, which means that two houses in Latin. So it's got male and female plants. Those plants that are producing seed and fruit are probably your priority. So look at getting rid of those because that's going to perpetuate the seed crop. But beyond that, just know it's going to be an undertaking, and there's a lot of information resources, DNR website, and then UW Extension on buckthorn control.
There you go. Thank you very much for that question. Well, Darren Kimbler, Janelle Ware, and Paul Segan, our guests today on Garden Talk, and it's always fun to visit Bayfield and have a chance to talk with listeners who we've got a great audience here today, and it's always a pleasure to visit with them. I'm Larry Mueller, and we are broadcasting from Bayfield, Wisconsin, the Bayfield Pavilion on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk, coming to you live from the Bayfield Lakeside Pavilion in beautiful Bayfield, Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here, really having a great time on the show today with our panel of experts. Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist from Hayward. Darren Kimbler, Ag Educator for UW Extension in Iron County. And Janelle Ware, a horticulture educator with UW Extension in Marathon and Wood Counties. So as we talk with them, some callers online. I know we've got this wonderful audience with us today in the studio. The place is filled. It's really nice. And getting lots of questions from them as well as the show moves along. But you can call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's see. Jill Nadeau is raising her hand to let me know that we have a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Ken. I've got a question about raspberries, jumping away from the trees. But my canes are prolific. The bed is pretty nicely thinned and maintained. And I've got last year's panicles where the berries were hanging on. Do I prune those off of a prolific cane? And the other thing would be, I do get plenty of berries, but they're small, and I'd like to get bigger berries like you get at the grocery store. And then the other part of my question would be, we've got a patch of rhubarb, and when we first planted that patch, they were, for 3 years, they were just wonderful. But now it just keeps declining, despite the fact that I'm adding compost and composted manure. Doesn't seem to help any.
Hard to kill rhubarb. But sorry for bringing that up. But maybe you want to, Janelle, you want to address the rhubarb or?
I was going to start with the raspberries.
Okay.
So with the smaller berries, some of the things that come to mind are, you know, thinking about that water supply, also thinking about making sure that they're really well mulched. And then last, just making sure you said that you're staying on top of them and they're thinned, right? You're pruning them out really well, because that's kind of the first thing that comes to mind, is making sure that we're adequately pruning them. So then I would start kind of thinking about those other pieces then, you know, as far as that water supply, because there are critical points in the growing season where that water becomes even, I mean, water is always critical, right? But there are points where, you know, for berry production, it's going to be even more critical. So you want to make sure that it's getting the water that it needs at, you know, and maintaining the correct moisture.
Is that about an inch a week or?
Generally, yeah. Generally an inch a week, depending on if you're in sandy soils, you might want to up that a little bit more. I live in the central sand, so, you know, we generally say an inch a week, but definitely depends a little bit on that soil. Darren, do you have any other suggestions?
I mean, it also comes down to maybe cultivar, too. You know, the cultivar that you have may be a smaller buried cultivar than those ones that are in the grocery store that are grown, you know, in Mexico and California. So you may be looking at it, you know, at just a cultivar thing. As far as the rhubarb, it's probably time you thin that out and divide the crowns. The crowns are probably getting a little too crowded, periodically you need to replenish that by dividing that. And that requires waiting till they're dormant in a very sharp spade to kind of divide that out and donate to your friends and family the...
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, or just move them down the line. Did you have another? Was there another question? I forgot.
No, I don't. I just.
Okay. Thank you very much for that question. Let's take a phone question here. Louise in Dodgeville. Your
Hi,
turn.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm actually responding to a previous question. I think it was from someone in the audience about the cleavers or catchweed or sticky willy. So we deal with the same thing. I'm in Southwest Wisconsin, and I just quickly looked it up online, and it's, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's G-A-L-I-U-M, and then second word, A-P-A-R-I-N-E. But it looks like it is not native, and it's in the same family as coffee, which I thought was interesting. And the fruits can be dried and roasted and used as a coffee substitute, which I was like, okay, that's interesting. But I'd rather have coffee and not this in my yard. So if you have any suggestions on how to get rid of it, or if it's just mechanical. But, yeah, if you go on a hike, it gets all over and sticks on you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that comment. Janelle?
Probably start with just mechanical, pulling that out. If it's what I'm thinking of, it's pretty easy to pull. It's not really deeply rooted. But, again, it's probably going to – my experience with it is if it's what I'm thinking of, it's pretty, like I said, pretty easy to pull, but it's one of those things that will spread, can be a bit of a challenge to deal with, and it just is a matter of staying on top of it.
All right. Thanks for calling, Louise. Appreciate your call. And Mary in North Lake, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure,
I just had a suggestion for the lady with the lots of buckthorn.
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I have had a lot, too, and still do. But what I do, and especially works well in spring, is girdle the whole tree with like an old butcher knife. They probably make a tool for that, but I don't have one. To girdle the tree and then spray it with the brush killer. And that kills that tree. Then you don't get the fruit in the fall, which also causes it to spread. Sometimes it suckers from the bottom. You can just cut those suckers off and spray those. I was going to try to not spray it and just girdle it and see if that took care of it, but I haven't gotten to experiment with that yet. So anyway.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. Darren, a comment from you?
You want to take it?
Sure, Darren, I'll take that. That's a really good point. That is an option to girdle the tree and then apply an herbicide onto that cut girdle. And that's a great way to not have to remove all that material. In some cases, you may not have a trailer, some piece of equipment, or the human power to move it. So that would be a good idea. Again, I would suggest trying to prioritize those berry-producing trees, but certainly as a lower-effort measure, girdling is good. Now, girdling without the herbicide is probably not going to get you the results you want because, again, that plant is very aggressive and is likely to basal resprout very prolifically.
All right, there we go. Thank you very much, Mary, for that. And we have a question from the audience.
Hi, Paul from Duluth. I have a question. The deer are eating everything in our yard. I want to know how I can get them to eat the bluebells that are in our yard.
They don't want those.
Make them very hungry. Deer are deer are a challenge in the north and pretty much anywhere, and especially in towns and cities up here because they don't have the pressure of hunting. They're pretty protected in the urban and suburban areas, so they are a challenge for lawn owners. And you know, you can't necessarily put up the big tall fences like you can out in the country to kind of protect. What the Extension does have a fact sheet on plants that deer dislike or don't prefer. And I say that don't prefer because a hungry deer will eat about anything. So I would probably start maybe, I don't know if I can help you with the bluebells, but you may want to start switching out some of your garden with some of these plants that are less preferred by the deer.
The other effective method is an outdoor dog.
But in a town, that's also becomes problematic.
Yes, that's a problem. You're absolutely right. All right. Thanks for that question. And let's take another call. Tamara from Ashland, let's go to you. Thank you for calling on the phone. Hi.
Hello there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have some pear trees that I planted outside in my yard, and I live close to the lake. I can see it from my street. And I was told that if I plant cedar trees next to these pear trees, they might be susceptible to a disease that they give to apples. So, apples, pears, and cedars, please.
Cedar apple rust. Yeah, okay. Go ahead, Darren.
So, are these cedars actually northern white cedar or arborvitae?
Arborvitae, and they would be from the local greenhouse up here. There's some very nice ones, and that's where I got my pear varieties from, too.
Sure. So, the disease that you're talking about is cedar apple rust or cedar quince rust. And it's a misnomer. It's actually not cedars or white cedars that are the alternate host. It's actually junipers, something like red cedar or common juniper or old field juniper. That's the alternate host. So the cedars that you planted are not the alternate host, and these rusts have to have both hosts present for the disease to actually proliferate and cause problems. So you may want to look around your neighbors and see if they have any junipers or so forth. But otherwise, the arborvitae, the cedar that you planted, should not cause a problem as far as the cedar apple rust or the gymnosporangium rust, as they call them.
Okay, there we go. And let's take a question from Roxanne in Delavan.
Hi there. I have some dappled willow plants that we planted. When would be the best time to prune them?
So you've got
little right now. So
little by what do you mean by little? Are they a foot tall or 5 feet tall?
They're not little. They're like they're about probably 15 feet tall now.
Oh, 15. Okay, and these are white
dappled willows.
Willows. Okay. Who wants to take that? Darren, you want to go ahead?
Well, with any pruning, I always recommend dormant season pruning during the wintertime when there's less likely of transferring disease to open wounds.
I like to do it late winter. That way, if there's any kind of winter kill, I can kind of identify that and put it into my pruning sort of plan. So depending on where you're at, if you're in the southern part of the state, that's sort of February for us up here. That's March, where we're still getting below freezing temperatures so that the wounds have time to sort of callus over and dry out before we start having disease and insects moving around.
Okay, thank you very much for that question. And we have a question from the audience again.
Hi, I'm Barb, and I live by Highbridge. The flood of 2016 found my house, and by 2017 in the fall, they had put in a new well because my well was gone, everything was gone. And they found a flowing well, 50 gallons a minute, so the pipe had to be 4 feet up, and it's still flowing. And it's in my yard, and now I have a pond, well, not even a pond, like that flowing to, because I'm in the country, right? And then it goes into the ravine. But I've got cattails everywhere, and out my back door I've got cattails now because of that. What can I plant there? What kind of plants can I plant in this water mess?
Actually, there are quite a few.
About the water flowing, it's going to flow forever.
So you're the, there's a lot of people jealous the fact that you now have a ready-made water feature in your, your lawn.
Yeah, I just wish I had the money to put like rocks in there too, and direct it instead of having it go like.
If you want rocks, my farm is full of them. You can come pick as much as you want.
Oh, I was going to say, do you deliver?
Well, we've got rain gardens that will, the plants that you would find in many of the rain gardens, Janelle, wouldn't they work?
Yeah. I think this area, is it really sunny or really shady?
No, it's wide open. It's 35 acres of, it's that's a farm.
Wide open.
It's
got
an old
it.
Farm that's not farmed anymore.
Yeah, but, so
it's in my yard. It's not like in the field.
Right. So you want things that are going to be a little bit more decorative and
something that will bring in the bees and the
Sure.
A couple of years back, there must have been, because it flows all winter, also. So like in March, there must have been 50 robins sitting there just drinking it up and having fun. But that's not helping the aesthetics of my yard.
Sure.
I can't even get close to mow it. It's all wet.
Yeah.
One perennial that's coming to mind right away is Joe Pieweed. So I think that might be something fun to add. And it is a big-time pollinator magnet. So since you've already got the water you've got the perfect conditions for Joe Pieweed, that would be one of the ones that I would start to look at. One of the things with Joe Pieweed is it can grow rather tall, but there are some smaller varieties on the market now. So I want to say off the top of my head, I think Joe Pieweed tends to be about maybe 5 feet tall, 5-6 feet tall. There's some smaller ones. There's a Baby Joe that's, I think, more in the 36-inch range. So you can kind of play around, too, with the different heights of them.
So do I plant it in the water or
no,
on the edge?
That's going to be on the edge. That's not going to be right in the middle of the water, no.
Okay.
If you're looking for, if you're looking for something that's going to outcompete those cattails, that I would recommend maybe getting a hold of me or Darren, and we can do a little bit of research to figure out what would be a better method, plants that might outcompete, or what your other options might be.
Yeah, it's a pretty perfect environment for cattails.
Absolutely.
To be honest, but I love the Joe Pieweed idea, especially that takes wet. Mm-hmm.
And marsh marigold.
And
the first thing in the spring would be a great thing. It's low growing. It produces those nice buttercup flowers, and that's a great, kick off your growing season. Especially since you've got that open water all year round, it's going to really give you early color, and it's a nice native up here as well.
Good suggestions, Lute in River Falls. Your turn. Hi, Lute.
Yeah, I'm looking at my problem right now. It's pretty icky. It's clumps of worms, and they are on a small pine. I think it's called a Mugel, M-U-G-H-O pine.
Yeah, Mugel pine.
Mm-hmm. And they're totally devouring it.
Yeah. You know what color they are? We don't even need to know, probably. But go get, what are they?
Yeah, they're kind of a gray green, and they have a couple of stripes in them.
Yeah. Again, this is similar to that call we got earlier. It's probably pine sawfly. I'm not sure which one. The best thing to do is take some pictures and probably send that into the insect diagnostics lab at UW-Madison with PJ Leash to get a confirmation. It's the time of year these sawfly larvae come out, about the time that the new needles come out, and they just really kind of munch on the end of those branches. And kind of take down theirs. There are chemicals out there that will work on it, but as with anything, before you use chemicals, we want to get a positive ID to make sure that we're giving in the right thing, because they are not caterpillars. They're actually sawfly larvae.
Yeah. So there you go. Thanks. Thanks so much for that question, Lute. Well, you know, before I forget about it, there's so many people to thank, and I did want to take a bit of time, a minute or two, just to say thanks to a whole lot of people who bring you this broadcast live from Bayfield. The Bayfield Chamber of Commerce, of course, has been very helpful and accommodating, our friends at the Old Rittenhouse Inn, want to thank them for their hospitality. We've had a wonderful time there. And, of course, we couldn't have done it without the steadfast support for WPR's Northern Regional Manager, Paul Damberg, and Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nalbandian. Lisa's not with us today. Paul is. And great for the work that they've done. And then thanks to our Central Regional Manager, where is he, Rick Ryer, and to Christina Myshock. Also, Jeffrey Potter and the entire marketing team for additional support. And then, of course, our technical directors making us sound good today. Tom Blaine with us here at the Bayfield Pavilion. Let's give him a hand. Yeah. He did a good job. And I hope Trina LaSousa is still... Trina is sitting back in Madison, and she's the one that's kind of... sending us phone calls and sort of a main operator here today, even though she's not here. So Trina LaSousa as well. And then Clara Neipert does the calls and emails as well, and is with the on-air producer. Jill Nadeau, of course, our producer for the whole show today. Yeah. Doesn't she sound good on the air as well? I was off playing in a golf tournament last week in Saskatchewan, and everybody says, well, why isn't she on more? thanks to her. Molly Stentz, of course, is our overall boss, our executive producer, and was hard at work yesterday getting everything together. And, of course, thanks to you, our audience and listeners, it's always such a pleasure to visit Bayfield and have a chance to meet with so many friends that we have and listeners. And we have a reception at the Bayfield Inn, and we'll be doing that between 1 and 3 today. And so lots of the Bayfield Inn folks are great. And Bayfield in Bloom continues throughout the week. Blessings of the Fleet take place on Sunday at 1, and then next weekend on June 11, there's the tours of the Bayfield area gardens. And if you're missing something if you don't get here to see those gardens. So lots of people to thank, but mostly I'm thankful that I was here today and had a chance to visit with everybody. And thanks to you for listening on the radio and for your calls and questions. And you know what? You should stay with us, because there's lots more in store right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.